Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So we're going to start with an email today just to warm things up. And the email is from Fred and in Bradley, California. And Fred writes, a potential danger associated with lion's mane mushroom. Hi, Dr. D. I thought this might be of interest important to some below. Please note a bit of scary email from a lifelong friend back east. By the way, as many of these days are, he and his wife have been growing several types of mushrooms at home. Hola, Fred. One of the many references to lion's mane blood thinner warnings. And there was my own experience, which was a bit unsettling and led to a hospital visit. Saludos and abrazos to you and Carol. So that was the email. Now let's move to lion's mane mushroom. Actually, many mushrooms have some blood thinning properties. And like other mushrooms, lion's mane contains a class of chemicals that called hericinones that reduce the risk of blood clots, which is good, but also if your blood is already too thin, could be a problem. These hericinones actually inhibit platelet aggregation. So that's basically your platelets are the first step in sticking together and blocking, essentially plugging up a hole. If that hole's made in your blood vessels or your skin, then the platelets are circulating in the blood at all time. They're immediately attracted to the collagen that's exposed when there's an injury. And because the cells, the lining of the blood system, of course, is basically fat. It's there shouldn't be any collagen in there. The collagen is underneath, like the springs in a mattress. Anyway, if a person has a bleeding disorder, they probably shouldn't be taking fish oil or green tea extract or a whole lot of things that have mild antiplatelets effect, nor should they be taking aspirin. Now, a person who's taking a blood thinner, and many people now are taking the type 10A inhibitors like Eliquis, it's recommended, just like with some of the other agents that I mentioned, fish oil and St. John's wort is actually very known for impeding blood clotting. So you're supposed to stop these things a couple of weeks before surgery. Once you've had your surgery and been stitched up, it's okay to resume them. And people who have a bleeding disorder should definitely talk with their doctor. I went looking for more detailed information, and all I could really find were general declarative statements, nothing that was terribly official sounding, Fred. So I hope that helps. If you're on aspirin, you probably don't, you might want to stop it if you haven't had a stroke, because the lion's mane is probably going to help your platelets enough to take over from it. I like the combination. I like lion's mane for its cognitive preservation effects. And again, you know, it's always a balancing act when you talk about things like this. And we have another anonymous email, and this was a little terse, but the anonymous writer said, fatty15.com, that's a website, offers various kits of fatty 15 pure C15:0 pentadecanoic acid supplement. Fatty 15 is marketed to supplement long-term health and wellness. So I got real science-y on this one, and I went to Biochimie, which is the French journal for biochemistry, and found a great article, which basically said it's negatively correlated with leptin. That's good. It's probably a blood thinner. It's has insulin-sensitizing effects, working similar on the same pathway that you see with metformin and with rapamycin, which are two of the anti-aging drugs. So it's hitting the same pathway. That's good. It's also been shown to reduce the severity of basically metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis. That's basically non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or NASH syndrome. They just use a different acronym in France. And it may have some anti-inflammatory properties. It's not synthesized endogenously, so you have to get it in diet. It's basically an essential fatty acid. The question really is, do you need it? Do you really need it? And what can you do about it? And should you be buying it? And when I looked through this article, all of these benefits that are being described here are basically in animals. And I found one study that found that it helped with weight gain in animals. I couldn't find any evidence for human studies except this one. And this was a study where they said basically if you use this stuff, you reduce liver fat deposition, and this helped lower fasting blood sugar and helped with the elevated liver enzymes. So I'd say it's promising. I don't know if, I think it's obviously being very heavily hyped here on the website link you showed me. I also suspect there are probably many other things that are cheaper, like berberine, that might get you the same results. And I guess you'll just have to make up your own mind. We run the risk now of getting over-supplemented, and it's very easy to just keep loading. Oh, that's good for that. Oh, I'll take that too. And before you know it, you're taking 20 or 30 pills a day. I don't recommend that. I recommend a food-first approach to nutrition and supplementation. And then if you have a targeted need, like, for example, I use a lot of high-dose quercetin for people with allergies, and berberine, 500 milligrams three times a day for people with either high cholesterol or prediabetes, or even not quite well enough controlled diabetes. It's obviously a nutrient. It's not as strong as a drug, but it also doesn't have some of the baggage that comes along, particularly in people who have difficulty with processing drugs and other agents. Oh, wait, we're getting a call. Hello, caller. Welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. This is Sibyl from, you said last time we could come to the studio and ask the question there.
Yeah.
Is that still okay?
Well, yeah, we'll just put you on a mic if you want. Okay, we're back. And we have a loyal listener and often emailer, Sibyl, who's come at my invitation. You know how sometimes you say, yeah, come on over anytime. And I meant it. But yeah, there's no one else here but me. So, Sibyl, you have a question. I'm going to pop up your mic.
You know, I called you earlier, a couple of months ago, about high blood pressure. And, you know, my lifestyle should not give me high blood pressure. And I think it's just stress because of moving and stuff. And so I got my blood pressure down. It's totally normal now. Like you said, L-arginine, and I drink hibiscus tea, mm-hmm. and a few things. But I was wondering, if my blood pressure is normal again, should I continue this, the L-arginine?
I would suggest it because it helps. It's very healthy. It helps your body make nitric oxide.
Yeah.
And it's one of those effects that if you stop adding it in, you'll go back to your previous setting.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll probably revert. Now, if you changed your lifestyle substantially and looking at the stress, I would say right now, I would not bet on there being more stress in all of our lives. So I would definitely not bet against lots of shocks and lots of stress in the next few years. And I think we all need to find our way through the forest. Mm-hmm. And meditation, walks in nature, gardening, things like that really help you remember where you are instead of where the media and all of the attention-grabbing stuff that surrounds us wants to put you. And you need to be, you know, feel your feet on the ground and be in nature,
because yes,
nature is very
always
healing. And but, you know, as you, how old are you now, if you don't mind my asking?
I'm going to be 70 in this December.
Yeah, and so the elasticity of some of your tissues is not what it used to be, I imagine you've noticed. And the elasticity of the blood vessels, some of the internal tissues, is not what it used to be. And that the blood vessels tend to be a bit stiffer. So when the heart beats, they don't stretch like a spring and then rewind. So the absolute pressure that you see, particularly on the upstroke of the heart, is a little higher. It's not dangerous, but over time it causes wear and tear. And that wear and tear can deposit plaque, or it can just make the arteries injured so they are less good at making nitric oxide. And so it becomes a feed-forward cycle, and you end up with the hypertension mm-hmm. that's permanent and irreversible because the tissue is too damaged to recover. So I would say think of that L-arginine as a kind of sunscreen for...
Okay. And I have a couple more quick questions.
Of course, go ahead. But do speak a little louder.
Okay.
There you go.
I'm taking iodine instead of kelp. I'm taking what's the name of the brand? Life Extension.
Okay.
Iodine. Mm-hmm. And it's 1,000 microgram. It's 1 milligram
right.
a day.
Okay.
Is that a safe?
That's a very safe dose. An unsafe dose would be, 25 milligrams a day. So, people in Japan who, and particularly like the island of Okinawa, where they eat a lot of kelp, and I'm not going to address that kelp, of course, is going to absorb toxins and heavy metals. And so I prefer iodine in a supplement form mm-hmm. for that reason.
Yeah.
But anyway, they consume about 4 milligrams daily on the average. And there's no problem with levels like that. People who have hypothyroidism can sometimes suppress their thyroid function with doses in the range of 12. But if you're healthy, you can probably take up to 25. And when there's a nuclear meltdown or a mushroom cloud on the horizon, you're supposed to take about 50 milligrams. And that only temporarily keeps, it's so much, it's like the refrigerator's full, the cupboard's full, the cooler is full. I don't need to go to the market. I'm not in the market for any more thyroid until I've, used up my supply here.
Yeah. And in Europe, we live close to 3 nuclear power plants. So the government is supplying iodine.
Yeah.
For people.
It's
a lot.
Yeah. I remember Fukushima. It's when you think about the risks of nuclear power in terms of the potential for pollution and contamination, it doesn't look as good. I know I really like my ChatGPT and all of that, but I think we're making a very poor choice as a civilization to start using this thing, because it's really making us lazy. And it's like we've already have an epidemic of diabetes and obesity because everybody's got a car or a motorized bicycle or whatever.
But you know what? If you're moving to another country and you have to navigate applying for everything mm-hmm. over there, it's really good to have, because it is an enormous amount of work otherwise without ChatGPT.
That's a situation, yes. But in terms of playing, I think there's a lot of look what this can do kind of stuff going on. And a lot of that is work that could be done with just a browser and a dedication of a little more time. We have some recent studies that come out on the topic that suggest, in fact, I covered that last week, that that kids' brains are, this is college kids, that they actually are not remembering what they've learned if they learn it using ChatGPT. And they can't even recognize their own essay from a series of essays, because it's not theirs, is it?
Yeah. And the last question is, I started Nusalt.
Yes, good.
And that's
potassium chloride and potassium chloride.
Yes, yeah. Potassium chloride. I cut out all salt. And what is the safe dose of that? Maybe a teaspoon or?
So the safe dose of potassium chloride, actually, we sometimes will give people 40 milligrams of microequivalents of potassium chloride. And that's like 15 to 20 milligrams. It's a lot. So 5 milligrams, which is a teaspoon, is fine. Two teaspoons is fine.
Okay.
And it will have the benefit of actually lowering your blood pressure
yes.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what's not to love about that?
Exactly. Okay.
All right.
That's done.
No, did you have a question? You're going to have to lean close to the mic
sure.
and tell us your name.
I'm Joseph, and I came here with Sibyl. So I wanted to comment on, actually ad lib on what she said first, and I had another question that's related. One of the things that she brought up was the potassium level. I guess we're looking at a similar recommended amount of 2.3 grams per day per adult. As it would be for sodium chloride, but we're not sure if I guess they're measuring the actual salt and not the potassium or the sodium that's in the salt, and so it's an equivalent amount, same amount of chloride.
Yes,
one would weigh a little more than the other one, but
a tiny bit, but doesn't make any difference in terms of solubility or anything.
Okay, that was one thing that I was curious about. Let's see, going back to your first question, can you? I just wanted to see it because I was ad-libbing.
I didn't write it down.
Okay. Well, related to something that you said about the memory, I was wondering that there are a number of memory-boosting formulas
yes.
on the market.
Nootropics, they're called.
And I suppose there are some things that are prescription, but there's also what you see advertised that's available over-the-counter
mm-hmm.
commercially. So I was wondering... if any of those are worth taking for boosting memory. I mean, they make all kinds of claims, but are there long-term side effects? Does it seem like it would be just helpful to use a nutraceutical approach to memory care?
One of the, oddly enough, nicotine and caffeine are both very effective nootropics.
Okay.
But, of course, they have some addictive properties, at least the nicotine does. Yes. I have been known to pop on a nicotine patch when I'm taking a test.
Interesting.
And I do find that it helps with my focus. And it's like, I don't feel, you know, it at all. It's just like, okay, that's a little boost. And lion's mane, which we talked about a few minutes ago on the show with mm-hmm. reference to its blood thinning properties, lion's mane actually works really well for as a nootropic. And to that, and lion's mane and caffeine, there's some local company is selling a coffee that's a blend of the two, and I have not personally tried it,
mm-hmm.
but it's gotten good reviews from a friend of mine who's a very, very bright person. So if he feels like he's brighter having taken it, it's like, well, that's interesting.
Yeah. First-hand account. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just don't want him to blow the top of his head off, you know?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Don't overdo it.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, what about, like, for example, Prevagen? I keep seeing the ad for that, and it looks like it's multifaceted.
Yes.
And then there's others that are maybe less well-known.
Well, well-known because of the amount of money put into the advertising.
Oh, it's just the ad.
Largely, I would think. Let me just look at Prevagen, because I'm seeing if I can get contents. If it says, here we are, ingredients. Let's see what's in that. Jellyfish and vitamin D3. Apoaquorin is a protein extracted from jellyfish that's claimed to improve brain function. I'd have to do more research before I could form an opinion. I'm not finding any references at the end of the articles.
Okay.
So anything that, by the way, if it has a reference at the end of the thing you read on the internet, click on the reference, go look at it, and see if it actually says anything whatsoever about the claim, because you can just do a search. If you can get into it and just search for the keyword.
Certainly.
So sometimes it's an article about memory drugs, but the drug that is putting it up there on their website isn't in the study or in the article. So you got to be a little tricky with the references.
I mean, certainly.
They love to blind us with detail. And we're going to go to our first caller. Hello, caller number one. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. And what is your name?
Kurt.
Kurt. Okay. Hello, Kurt. And welcome. Where are you calling from?
Santa Cruz.
All right, Kurt. What can I do for you today?
Well, I've been listening to your program for a long time, and I'm very have gotten lots of great information from you. So I recently started to lose some weight. I've been depressed for a number of years, clinical depression, and I've been overweight, not a lot, but carrying probably extra 30, 35 pounds more than I should. And so I weigh about 205, and I think my best weight is like 175, 180. And so I was offered through my psychologist, they have a nurse practitioner, and they said if I wanted to try tirzepatide, which is a weight loss drug, mm-hmm. That I could do that through them. And so I'm on my second week. I just had the second injection yesterday. It's a once a week injection.
Right.
And yeah. I'm in relatively good health. Never had anything serious, metabolic issues. I've, had spinal surgery from a helicopter accident I was in and a bunch of stuff like that, but a pretty good health overall. And so I've noticed some difference. They kind of gave me some information, but you come up with some amazing information, and I just wanted to get your take on what you would advise someone who's at my age, and I'm noticing some muscle loss now. So my concern is I don't want to lose any more muscle mass.
Right.
I absolutely have to. So I'm trying to exercise more and do stuff.
Good. Yeah, you need to also boot up your branched-chain amino acids. You can buy that as a powdered supplement. And then especially if you're doing weightlifting or something, take about 20 to 30 grams of protein before your main exercise of the day. How old are you?
Okay. I'm 73.
Okay, so at your age, if you drink like the protein shake, the amount you need is 20 grams of these branched chain amino acids. And what happens when you take that is that you can actually make new muscle protein. Younger people can make new muscle protein fasting if they exercise. But when you're older, you actually need the protein circulating in your bloodstream while you're exercising. And what that does is it turns on the DNA, wakes up the DNA to make the muscle fibers. A lot of people are getting into time-limited eating. And the key is if you're older and you exercise while fasting, you're ketotic and all of that, but you can't trigger the production of the muscle protein because it isn't going to happen. So you can improve your cardiovascular fitness, but you won't build muscle. So that's one trick. Make sure that the thing I worry about with these drugs, this is Mounjaro, by the way, for my audience, you may be more familiar with tirzepatide from that, but from that name. But if you stop taking it and you haven't changed your behavior, you're going to gain the weight back because this is changing your behavior and it's making
I've changed. I've been a pretty healthy eater. Probably at least half of my meals are vegetables. I love.
Yeah, but you got to 35 pounds overweight doing what you've been doing.
Well, no, I've actually lost a little bit of weight, but I'm trying to speed it up because I'm not going to live long enough.
Okay. All right. So you already made those good dietary changes was what I'm hearing.
I am. And they're giving me diet counseling as well. But I wanted to get your take on it. So
I think it's,
I think
it's fine.
You're giving me good bullet items to follow.
Yeah. So the protein, make sure you get enough. Make sure you're exercising. I would do upper body one day, lower body the next, and alternate every day. And you could take some DHEA, which your body will convert to testosterone if your testosterone is low. You might ask your provider to check your testosterone level and see where you fall in the norm for your age. Because if a person has low T, they won't build.
I was getting the cream supplement, but my insurance company didn't want to pay for it. They said it was a lifestyle thing, and I couldn't afford it otherwise. So I'm kind of on the margin a little bit,
I hear you.
Testosterone.
But I think that, like I said, the DHEA is a natural compound. It's oral. You can buy it at the health food store, and it will
supplements. And I don't know. I really am. I have a pre-med background, but when I look at the supplements today, I don't know what to think. The science has changed so much in 40 years.
Well, that's why I'm here, is to help people hack their way,
give
you a flashlight to make it through the forest. I'm going to sign off, and we'll go to a station break. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye, Kurt. And we still have a very patient caller online. Hello, caller.
Hello,
and thank you for being so patient.
I like listening.
Oh, okay. What's your name, and where are you calling from?
My name is John Santa Cruz.
John in Santa Cruz, and what can we do for you today?
Well, I actually have two questions. I'm 74, and the question is maybe some reasons for what I consider a rapid resting pulse rate. It usually goes between 80 and 100 beats a minute. I stopped drinking coffee 7 months ago. I've fallen off on exercise. I eat one meal a day, and my weight keeps pretty much within a half a pound as I weigh myself day by day. So what might be some contributing factors to high resting pulse rate?
Well, what's your blood pressure normally?
I don't have a blood pressure, but it used to be about 115 over about 85.
Okay. A lot of the pharmacies, the big chains, will have a blood pressure device. You can just check. You can sit in there.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, sit on the chair for a couple of minutes. Make sure you're not listening to the news. And take some deep breaths and just kind of chill, you know, and then push the button and take your blood pressure. And if the blood pressure is low, the heart rate goes up to compensate.
So
you might have a low blood pressure, and there's lots of reasons that can occur. But another thing to notice is whether the heartbeat is much faster when you first stand up or when you've been standing for a long time. If your heart rate goes up, because the blood may be pooling in your legs, and as we age, that reflex to tighten up the blood vessels in the legs gets a little sluggish, doesn't work quite as well as it used to. So that could be part of what's going on.
Okay. Well, then my last question is, I watch way too much YouTube. And with that, they've now started to do commercials, multiple commercials, and there are so many drug commercials. What's your opinion? I remember they used to say, well, ask your doctor about what do you think about that? And is by the drug companies sparking the, you better ask your doctor about this particular drug. How does that fit in with your patient care?
Well, I hated that they allowed direct-to-consumer advertising for drugs. It happened on my watch, oh gosh, has to be 20 years ago. And I remember in particular the advertising blitz for Claritin, which lurasidine, which in my opinion wasn't all that effective a drug, but everybody came in wanting it. And then the toenail fungus drugs started advertising, and then they had this really good ad where this cute buff guy is like, girls walking by, and he hides his toenails in the sand because he's ashamed of his toenails. And, you know, it was like those old Underarm deodorant ads that made all of us go out and buy Underarm deodorant in the 60s. So the advertising and the power of suggestion is so powerful, and they like to evoke an emotion. And then once your emotion's evoked, once you're like fear or shame or something like that, your frontal cortex turns off. I mean, it literally, the amount of blood flowing to the front of your brain where you do your thinking drops, and the amount going to the fight or flight emotional reaction part goes up, and you become a little bit stupider. I really don't encourage listening to any of the ads. And it's kind of ridiculous sometimes. I always laugh at the end when they list all of the possible side effects. But they thought, well, that'll be okay. We'll just list all of the possible side effects, and then, you know, people can make their own decision, because we know how smart the American people are. And, you know, they can be trusted to make a good decision. And That was kind of the rationale for allowing this, and it's become, you know, an absolute monster. So, and also, you know, it's driving huge corporate profits. So the people who are writing, doing these ads, do you remember a couple Super Bowls ago when there were when there was like a ton of ads for crypto? When they, and I remember it because there were, it was all like, don't miss out, you know, don't be the person who doesn't become a millionaire by buying, I forget even what coin it was. And, you know, they're just messing with you. They're making you fear something. They're creating a need, and then they're offering to fill the need. And for the most part, if you actually have a disease, there's an older, cheaper, safer drug out there. And that's not always the case, but most of the time it is. So why are you, you know, why are you spending all this money? You'll pay it off. You'll pay it in the end, either in taxes or in wait times because they cut Medicare rates and nobody will take new Medicare patients, or whatever happens to try to compensate for us wasting all the money. In fact, if so, that's what I think.
Okay. It goes back to Henry J. Kaiser's statement, find a need and fill it.
Henry J. Kaiser, and what was he selling?
Cement.
Ah, well, very good. That's exactly who I was quoting without knowing who I was quoting.
Cement and steel. Do you remember hearing about Liberty ships during World War II?
Yes. Yes. Don't we have a sunk one off the Capitola Pier?
We have a cement ship.
Liberty. Okay, well, go ahead.
Cement versus Liberty. The Liberty ships were a makeup of Henry J. Kaiser's brain. They could produce one every couple of days, if that, and they just flushed them into the war, and those ships helped save the war for the U.S.
Well, that was quite a war, so...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate your help, and have a good day.
You as well. Bye-bye. Well, I think I will pivot from that last caller and talk just briefly, I'll try to keep it brief, about something you're bound to be hearing about soon, and that's p-tau 217. Now, tau protein is a protein that's normally found in the brain, and it's a part of the neuron, and it's serving a purpose. But when people develop Alzheimer's and dementia, we see abnormal kind of tangles of this normal fiber, like Rastafarian hair instead of nice straight surfer girl hair. And so they're both hair, but one of them, you're not going to be running your fingers through. And those tangles seem to interfere with the health of the neurons and lead to neuronal death. The idea that we might be able to take people who are, let's say, in their 60s or 70s, starting to have a little cognitive issue and do screening on them and see, well, what levels of this tau 217 have you got? And if you've got high levels, we could put you on a drug that would help you not develop Alzheimer's. And the potential market for, you know, creating this need and then filling it is huge. The problem, or one of the problems, is with the test, and the other problem is with the drug. And because this is market-driven, you're not hearing the straight story about this. Eric Topol, who is a scientist down at Scripps in San Diego, a man I've always respected very much for his open-mindedness in science, has kind of gone the way that Andrew Weil did in the 90s. He's become a monolith. He's got all kinds of people writing blogs. He posts, he has a podcast. There's no way one human can be doing this. So he's got a lot of people writing, and they're not as smart as him. And so a lot of the stuff that's coming off of his website purporting to have been from him, I don't think is true. I mean, I don't think it's from him. I think it's also in the case of his unrelenting positive idea that this p-tau 217 is a breakthrough test that can accurately predict and potentially prevent Alzheimer's disease. So what are we doing before this test came along? Well, we could do a PET scan of the brain, and that would show tau protein. We could, and it turns out, and I covered this about a year and a half ago, tau protein correlates better with Alzheimer's than the one you've all heard of, beta amyloid. Beta amyloid is probably a symptom. It's not clear whether tau protein is a symptom of Alzheimer's either. We don't know, but we do see a loose correlation with very high levels of tau 217 in the blood. The problem is, if you're below a level of about 10, it's just a scattergram. You have no higher probability of having Alzheimer's. We're talking about general population or your cognitive regression, which is something that does happen as we age, is not due to Alzheimer's disease. So if the test gets out there in the world and doctors start ordering it, and I had my first patient come back and who had this test and wanted advice, and it's like, well, hon, your level is 3, and that's not none, but the predictive value of that for Alzheimer's is 50-50. So in other words, flip a coin and you'd have just as much information. And what are we going to do about preventing Alzheimer's? Well, we could control our blood sugar. We could reduce we could take hormone therapy and get our brain hormones in order. We could make sure we don't have a whole bunch of mercury poisoning our brain. Those are all things that are, I think, quite legitimate. But that's primary prevention. Going on these drugs is a ridiculous idea. We're going to hurt a lot more people than we help, because a lot of these people with low tau 217 aren't going to progress to Alzheimer's, and they just, it's garbage. It's lying around in their brain. We all have garbage lying around in their brain by the time we get into the 60s. What flavor is it is variable. But the drugs that were recently released by the FDA are horrible drugs. And I'm talking specifically about one called donanemab. Brand name is Kisunla. And this has some of the worst complications you can imagine. It can cause brain swelling. It can cause brain hemorrhage. It can cause seizures and confusion and visual changes, and also a whole bunch of other side effects, and some people are allergic to it. So it makes no sense to go out and screen the population with a test that is actually not a very good screening test for the general population. So I'm going to explain what I mean by that. Let's suppose that in the general population of 40-year-olds, there's 1 in 1,000 who's going to develop a disease. And the test is 90% accurate. This test is not 90% accurate, but it's like 80% accurate, which is not good enough for a screening test, by the way. So it's 90% accurate in diagnosing the disease, but that means it has 10% false positives. Now let's take those 1,000 people. I've just said that the prevalence is 1 in 1,000. So if you test those 1,000 people, you're going to get one true positive, but like I said, 10% false positive, so that's 100 false positives. And if it's 99% accurate, you're still in a low prevalence, low risk population, got 10 false positives for every true positive. So then the false positives are going to be injured, both in terms of their stress and putting them on a drug. Putting them on a drug paid for by Medicare, it'll break the budget, but who cares, right? Creating this particular fear and promoting this very inadequate test. So my message, folks, is if you go in with memory problems and your doctor offers you this test, don't get it. Just don't, because there's nothing you can do that you can't already do, which is to say, start exercising, control your stress, start getting enough sleep, cut off the booze, cut out the sugar. I mean, you don't need to be taking a drug to do these things. And if you're worried about your memory, those are the first steps you should be taking, because they make a huge difference. And just getting rid of the crap that's in your body, that's hanging around, and getting decent sleep makes an enormous difference to most people's brain function. So ultimately, this idea of, it's called Bayes' theorem, and it's the idea that if you have to look at the frequency of the disease and the accuracy of the test to find the disease, and also the predictive value, the negative predictive value. So if the test is negative, what's the risk that you actually have it and we're missing it? And so this gets very complicated, and it gets oversimplified, and people end up making poor choices because of fear and salesmanship. So that's my little editorial. So getting back to another, the FDA just approved a blood test for screening for colon cancer. The study involved 8,000 people. The test detected colorectal cancer on 83% of the participants found to have colon cancer on colonoscopy. But its sensitivity for detecting precancerous growths, in other words, the things that colonoscopy would check, because they'd go in there and they'd see a polyp and they'd take it out before it turned in to a pre-melanoma, if you want to think of it that way. That's a funny-looking mole, and it grew really quickly. Let's just take that off and check it. Well, colonoscopy will get them in there to see it. This test, basically, the horse has left the barn by the time the test is positive. So it's a terrible screening test for exactly the reason. And this is in a high-prevalence cancer, right? This is in one where one in, I think the number is, lifetime risk of breast cancer for women who live to be 85 is 1 in 8. And lifetime risk of colon cancer for anybody who lives to be 85 is 1 in 15. So it's pretty common. It's pretty prevalent. And as I covered a few weeks ago, it's become more prevalent in the younger generation, and people are getting more aggressive colon cancers earlier. We've just dropped the screening age recommendation to 45 from 50. And there are people in their 30s showing up with stage 4 colon cancer. And that was just like diabetes in grade school kids. That was unheard of. I mean, type 2 diabetes in grade school kids, obesity in grade school kids, that was rare. Type 2 diabetes was non-existent. Colon cancer at that age without a genetic predisposition, pretty darn rare. Not any longer. The numbers are, you know, literally doubling. It's still a small percentage of the colon cancer, but it's happening in people who physiologically, historically, have not been vulnerable to that disease. So we don't know what's up, and I don't think this test is going to help us. I think the Cologuard test, which at least is looking at, it has a reasonable screening potential, and it's sort of replacing, if you have a colonoscopy once and you at 50 and you don't have polyps, it's reasonable to get a Cologuard test annually and a FIT test. And if those are negative, you probably can avoid the colonoscopies. But again, we have to wait 20 years until we're sure of our data, because we have to let those diseases develop and make sure that we're catching them. The main thing, and it goes all the way back to the Hippocratic Oath, is do no harm. Citizens United comes to mind. Think of the long-term implications of your decision before you decide, because sometimes something looks innocent enough or plausible enough. But if you stopped for a minute and said, well, if it's like playing chess, right? Well, if I move my queen there, they could move their rook there. And then, oh, well, maybe I don't want to move my queen there. At least think two steps ahead, because I'll tell you, the unscrupulous people are about 4 or 5 steps ahead of you at any given moment. So let's at least take a moment and think. Well, I want to thank my impromptu guests, and so I'm putting your mics back on. And okay. Would you like to say goodbye to the studio audience?
Sure. That brought the one caller just brought another question.
Well, if I real quick, you've got like we got like 2 minutes.
Okay, you said you see I used to I mean I'm still going running and I do intermittent fasting, so I don't do any protein powder, don't take any protein before my run, only after. Is that still a good idea?
Well, you're not going to build muscle. But you're not going. But it's good for your heart. So you get the cardiac benefits, but you won't get the muscle building benefits. So you won't get the strengthening that you might otherwise get.
Okay. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
There's a test called a bioimpedance analysis where they can measure your percentage body fat and your percentage lean body mass, and I track that annually on all of my seniors. Just because if they start to lose lean body mass, that I really get in their face about, you know, weightlifting and walking uphill or bicycling uphill. You have to push your body on a regular basis, or it will get weaker. And
yeah, I go to the gym every other day.
Good for you. And make sure you protect your joints, but keep those weights up there. It's good for you.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very
much. Impromptu guests. I love it. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.